I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to take another look at Intersections, an innovative set of stories by WFYI's Ryan Delaney about Indianapolis's most distressed neighborhoods and the people who live in them. We'll talk about what's being done and how well it's working. My guests are Ryan Delaney of WFYI, Brianka Merritt of Indiana University School of Public Environmental Affairs Public Policy Institute, Eric Saunders of Big Brothers Big Sisters, and Jay Height, pastor at Shepherd Community Center. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits at WFYI.org, or track us down on social media. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be taking another look at the Intersection series by WFYI's Ryan Delaney today on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, my guests are WFYI's own Ryan Delaney.
Hey, John.
Hey, Brianka Merritt from SPIA's Public Policy Institute. Eric Saunders, who grew up near East 42nd Street and Post Road and the Meadows, which are both now focus areas of Intersections. And he is presently the Voluntary Outreach and Engagement Coordinator for Big Brothers and Big Sisters. And Jay Height, who's joining us by phone. He's the pastor at Shepherd Community Center in the Near East Side focus area. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Hello. It's good to have you here. I think probably the way to start this conversation is by giving people a taste of some of the reporting that you've done, Ryan. And I'm going to ask you to set up. We're going to listen to several pieces here. Some of them are pieces of Ryan's reporting. Some of them are just voices of people in the communities. We'll start with, could you set up this first piece we're going to be listening to?
Yeah, absolutely. This was the first story that I did last fall. The main person you're going to hear from is Troy Riggs, who at the time was the director of public safety here in Indianapolis. He's now the police chief under Mayor Joe Hogsett. And he's the one that really kind of dreamt up this approach to reducing violence. It took about 2 years' worth of statistics in the city, murder and shooting rates, as well as poverty, mental health runs, abandoned housing, and identified these six neighborhoods in the city and labeled them off of their main cross street intersections, and wanted to try a holistic approach, basically would be the buzzword there, to tackle this. And I went out with Chief Riggs in one of these focus areas at one of these mobile food banks as well, and talked to him a couple times. So this is part of that first story.
We have 8 square miles we're talking about today out of 400 in the city of Indianapolis, where 4.7% of our population resides. But yet they live in areas where 20% of the homicides occur, 27% non-fatal shootings, 14+% of all mental health runs in the entire city are made in 8 square miles.
The shifting urban landscape has isolated poverty. Gentrification has further concentrated it, creating the right environment for crime. And while each of these neighborhoods is unique, they share similar problems, like here on the northwest side, where every third home is boarded up.
Any area that's having trouble, that has a degradation of quality of life, and that's really what we're talking about. Crime is an after effect. When you look at this, the breakdown of family is one of the glaring issues in each one of these areas. That leads to a lot of issues, lack of education, lack of coping skills, a lack of people being fed properly.
Riggs brought together more than 30 community and nonprofit groups to begin working on issues like mental health care, hunger, and blight, underlying issues that drive criminal behavior. Riggs acknowledges crime in these neighborhoods could get worse before it gets better. He says that's why this needs to be a long-term effort.
Here's how we're going to know we're going to be successful. When every one of these areas has some type of organic leader, community leader in those areas, where DPS is not leading the charge, DPS is being held accountable.
That was now Indianapolis Police Chief Troy Riggs. He's actually been through several titles in the past few few months at the time that that story, which is part of an innovative series called Intersections by Ryan Delaney of WFYI News. At the time that that interview was done, he was actually the director of public safety, and then he had another job in between before he came to be police chief. He's talking about his holistic approach to dealing with not just crime, but community challenges in Indianapolis's most distressed neighborhoods, and that's what we're talking about today. Brianka Merritt, your work was actually one of the inspirations for this approach. Could you talk a little bit about how you began studying this and what you found?
Sure. So my background is really in a lot of the root causes that Ryan talks about in his series. So looking at things like poverty, education, and just general opportunities for any individual to be successful in the long term. So Troy was actually working with us at the IU Public Policy Institute, and he had this idea for, why don't we come up with a report that talks about what some of these systemic issues are and have a little bit of a blueprint for some general ideas and solutions that policymakers, community leaders could gather around and just look at that report and have a general starting point for understanding what some of those causes are.
And what did you find with your research?
Well, with this research, it's something that I think is ongoing. What we've done is kind of just uncover a lot of research that already exists. So a lot of the statistics that you see, people have been working on this for years, and what this is just a compilation. So generally looking at the focus areas, unemployment is higher there than it is in the rest of the city. Poverty is higher. We see more children in households in poverty in the focus areas compared to the rest of the city. Same with other issues such as mental illnesses. We see people who report having some sort of substance abuse issues. They're all higher in those focus areas when you compare it to the rest of the city. So again, just highlighting the concentrated nature of a lot of these root causes.
Eric, you actually deal with this from two ends. I mean, you grew up in one of those areas that is considered distressed, and you now work as a coordinator with Big Brothers Big Sisters.
Yes.
So you see it from from a different perspective.
Absolutely, man. It's been a full spectrum.
Yeah. So if you could give us some insight, maybe a portrait of how life is different in one of those distressed areas than it would be, say, in one of Indianapolis's suburbs.
You know, it's interesting that you say that. And before I even go on, I got to give a shout out to my alma mater, Cathedral High School.
Okay.
And that's probably awkward on this conversation a little bit. But the reason why I bring that up is because that was the first time I was actually able to see one of those suburbs. I grew up a public school student on East Side, 39th Hillside, 40th and Keystone, 42nd and Post Road, 55th and Ralston. So you would notice that was more than one home.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I see a lot of the youth that we serve today dealing with that same type of, where do I actually call my home? Where do I call my community? And so when you look at the suburbs and areas like that, and you see, you can tell the difference in a grocery store. I can see the difference in the grass. I can see the difference in the security. And you begin to notice all those differences. But so when I say that, by going to a school that I was able to go to, it wasn't because we came for riches or anything like that. But it was an opportunity that the school offers to be there. And so just interacting with so many people that did not look like me. At one time, and just trying to, get questions like, well, why does your hair look like that? Why do you brush your hair? And so all these things begin to, try to, at least ask me, what world am I living in now? And what world do I have to live with and deal with? And this was at the age of 15 years old, just really kind of having this onslaught of really understanding that I'm at school with a bunch of folks that do not really understand where I come from. And even going back to where I come from, people say, oh, you think you're better than everybody else because you go over here. I say, no, because I still got to come back home right here over in Hood. And so so just being able to see that at an early age, that contrast and understanding that, that you're playing a different ball game to where it feels like some people already have a leg up on you. So,
Jay, I can't help but think that the sort of circumstances Eric's talking about, people who live in these neighborhoods develop something resembling a bunker mentality, that they feel as if they're almost under siege. Is that the case?
Well, I think that the core issue is the lack of hopelessness. And so the bunker mentality comes when you think that there is no hope and that there can be no change, that this is just my lot in life. And I think in the writings of Robert Putnam and his books, talks about this idea that we've lost this ability to connect, that we've lost community, and with no community, it's very lonely. And so we have lots of people living in small areas who don't know each other and who are, at the core, very, very lonely.
If you are just joining us, we're talking about some of the most distressed neighborhoods in Indianapolis. It's part of an ongoing series of stories called Intersections by WFYI's Ryan Delaney. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. One of the things that I think is interesting about this is that there are opportunities for people who live in these neighborhoods actually to speak up using a rather innovative system where they get a prompt, the speak up phones. We've got the voices. We're going to play some of the voices of people who live in these neighborhoods. We're going to start with the one that is from a listener named Jeffrey. If we could listen to that right now.
Jeffrey Kirkpatrick, age 61. The one word that I would use to describe my neighborhood is abandoned. I choose that word because there are so many abandoned homes, the one next door to mine being a case in point. It's been abandoned for over 10 years. I've owned my home for 10 years. That home next to mine is falling apart. I put a new roof on my house, and I feel a fool for doing that on some level. I feel a fool to be putting money into my home when I cannot do anything. I am powerless to do anything about the other abandoned homes in the neighborhood. But the positive side is there are kids who play in the streets in my neighborhood. The talk of the crime and everything, I don't see it that active. It is a neighborhood. There are good people here.
And that was a listener named Jeffrey who was talking about life in his neighborhood. Jay, I understand your distinction between hopelessness, but you listen to Jeffrey's voice. There's a lot of frustration there, too. How do you speak to people who are frustrated by, you know, not just perhaps a city's indifference, but also some of their neighbors' indifference?
Well, I think the mistake that sometimes I've made, and my family and I have lived here for 20 years in the Near East Side, and the mistake I make is to think that they want to hear from me, and I think moreover, what they want is to be heard. And as we began to do a listening tour of our neighborhood, we heard some really interesting things. And the reality is many of our neighbors are incredibly brilliant folks who have great solutions. They just want someone to hear them and then to help them do what they could do for the neighborhood. But they've given up that hope and like you said, bunker mentality. They've given up hope, so they're just going to shut down and try to survive, but they have great ideas. And so increasingly our challenge is to take time to listen.
Ryan, what has the response been to your reporting? I mean, that I'm guessing that some of these places don't get a lot of media attention.
Well, I think it's a different kind of media attention that we're trying to give, and that was the motivation or the inspiration for the Speak Up Phone tour, was that what you hear about from these neighborhood about these neighborhoods on the news is so often just that, you know, standard B-roll of police lights and sirens and the quote from a detective explaining the latest shooting or homicide or robbery in these neighborhoods. And I really wanted to go past that and really hear from people that live in these neighborhoods and really get their reality versus the perception that is on the news so often.
And that is, I remember a colleague of mine when I was still in the newspaper business expressing frustration about the traditional media coverage said flatly, he was African-American, said, the only time I see a black man on the front page of the newspaper, he's either wearing a basketball jersey or he's in handcuffs. you know, that has to be, I would think, a maddening kind of dynamic to cut through, Brianka.
I'd agree. I think when we're talking about this man who said that he felt abandoned, I think that there's also, as we've all alluded to, an abandonment from the political system and from society and from greater Indianapolis. And I think part of what Ryan's uncovering, and also in the report as well, is that crime is simply a complex issue, and that it's a wicked problem. It requires a lot of collaboration, people from all sectors coming together to help solve some of those issues.
We are talking about Intersections, a series of stories about Indianapolis's most distressed areas. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about Indianapolis's most distressed areas and the people who live in them. It's those neighborhoods are the focus of an innovative series of stories called Intersections by WFYI's Ryan Delaney. Ryan is one of my guests, along with Brianka Merritt from SPIA's Public Policy Institute, Eric Saunders, who grew up in it sounds like several of those distressed neighborhoods, and is presently the voluntary outreach and engagement coordinator for Big Brothers Big Sisters, and Jay Height, who is pastor at the Shepherd Community Center in the Near East Side focus area. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. So, Ryan, I want to give people a little more, a larger taste of your reporting here. We've got a second piece we're going to play. Could you set it up real briefly?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the big issues that we wanted to look at, one of those sort of root causes of crime, is reentry, people coming out of prison. Obviously, these are people who have already committed their first crime, and it's a big issue to make sure that they do not commit a second one. However, about over half of the people, and we're talking about thousands and thousands of people that are leaving state prisons, you know, county jail every year and coming back to life. Statistics that, you know, Brianka has crunched, half of them will end up back in the criminal justice system. And, you know, that's millions of dollars of taxpayer money, and just this cycle, and breaking that cycle is incredibly important. And I spent time with a man named Stephen Buford, who is 25 now. He went to prison his first time when he was 18, mm-hmm. And has been in and out, and really talked to him about how hard it is to, you know, kind of break that cycle and to stay out for good. I met Stephen Buford at Westside Community Ministry. He's well tattooed, some of the ink work his own. Buford went to prison the first time when he was 18 on an armed robbery conviction. He says he was hanging out with the wrong people at the wrong time, but getting locked up only exposed him to more bad influences. And over the next 6 years, he cycled in and out of prison, serving his last sentence for theft.
I didn't have no goals or anything really set in my life at the time. I was already just, you know, looking for something to cling on to, or just like a boy or a man or something would cling to a gang or something, just looking for a little guidance or something. I was just out there wandering around.
Buford gets excited easily, but it quickly fades when he starts talking about his struggles. He's dealt with a common problem for ex-felons: depression, burdened by pressures to provide for himself, troubles with his family, and raising a baby girl.
Yeah, I don't know, it just weighs on me. I feel like I gotta do more. And I'm 25 and I ain't got too much done, you know. I ain't got a lot of stuff done. I feel like I should be ahead in life.
He's far behind. He didn't finish high school. He doesn't have a driver's license. On top of that, Ward says many employers shy away from ex-felons like Buford.
Stephen has a robbery conviction, and which is a hellified thing, you know. So it's going to take every bit of 7 years for that to go away, for him to even get a fair chance.
Buford has been out of prison since the summer of 2014, which means 7 more years before he can try to get the convictions erased from his record. 7 more years of a hard time getting by. He's strung together some work, but they're temp warehousing positions that only last a few weeks. He also applied at businesses around the West Side.
But they say your background. They sent me paperwork. I was like, that's crazy. That's crazy. really bothers me though sometimes, but at the same time, I can't give up. Then I don't want to be back in the jail. And I'm going back in that cell.
That was one of the stories that Ryan Delaney, a WFYI News reporter, has done for a series called Intersections. The details life in some of Indianapolis's most distressed neighborhoods. If you'd like to see the entire project, you can find it at WFYI.org/intersections. We've gotten an email from a listener that I think was responding to Eric's comments earlier. This is from a listener named Heidi, and if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Heidi says, I grew up on 42nd and Post in the 90s. I'm 39 now, and I always knew I wanted more than that. The problem is not what resources are available. The problem is knowledge. People can only do what they can see and understand. As long as the thought and ideas of the people are the same, the circumstances will remain. It is passed on from generation to generation. They view people who are educated as them thinking they are better than them, than us. As long as they believe that they are less than, they will remain that way. I never believed that. How do you convince people that they are more and that they are better than what they are living up to if they aren't told that as children when they are being raised? I don't know how to do that. Seems to me she's really drilling in here on what creates this cycle that we're talking about. I'd like to hear, actually, Eric, Bianca, and Jay all respond to Heidi's emails, because this seems to me to be the essential challenge, which is how do you get into that culture? Eric, I'm going to start with you.
I know Pastor Jay Height is still on the line here. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because what you hear a lot now is we must take a holistic approach. And so my question to that is, who's going to offer up the repentance? Because when we put things in context, and Brian put this in his report, this didn't happen overnight. And even when we talk about the prison system, you know, we can take that conversation back to the chain gangs, mm-hmm. which has perpetuated throughout these through decades, mm-hmm. to where it's generational through families and this has breakdowns through families over generation. And I'm talking across the board, but mostly all people that are living in poverty.
Yeah, there is a reap. Right. You reap what you sow.
Right. And so it's just to me, it's like what I say to her and to Heidi over the phone is one of the things I always love to do is build rapport with parents, because a lot of times, again, like she said, this is just what I've been seeing. So I'm passing down what I've seen to this child. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people say the parents need this. And I say, well, who's going to do it? A lot of people are afraid to approach the parents. You have educators that might be afraid to approach the parents. You might have professionals that might be able to approach the parents on their level. Okay, I think you have a PhD and law degree, and I'm not saying you, but you might not be able to communicate to this person who was barely able to get a high school degree. And so if that's the only thing in which you are holding your standards against, I'd like to come back to that one thing in which we all were from the beginning, and that's just human beings. Mm-hmm. Communicate with that person with love. Mm-hmm. Communicate with that person with realness. And to Heidi, you have to understand, this is just me being the poet. I said the same thing that is in you is the same thing that created the universe. Mm-hmm. And so you look deep down inside and just really know that you can do anything. And it's out there, and the knowledge is out there. I have a lot of friends out here in the community that are growing and really getting tired of it and getting sick of it, and really are just spreading knowledge to people on how to believe in themselves and how to believe in, and to dig deeper into, mm-hmm. what you've been taught and to question it. And we have arrived at that time where everything has to be come into question.
There is a dynamic, though, Bianca. I mean, this is not the first time we've talked about this issue on this program, and you will hear there is a dynamic often that by advancing yourself or by attempting to break the cycle, you are almost betraying your roots, which becomes kind of a self-perpetuating thing. Could you speak to that a little bit?
I think it's a little more complex than that. So if we think about another example, the heroin crisis that's going on in rural Indiana. They attribute that oftentimes to the manufacturing decline across the state. Marion County had a manufacturing decline, too, and a lot of those African Americans in the city worked for a lot of those factories, and those opportunities are gone. So if you're talking about alternatives to higher education, like Eric said, where are the opportunities for people who maybe do not want to pursue that or maybe cannot? So even though, yes, it does take a lot, I think it sounds really simple to say, oh, well, you just work hard and you'll get out of it. I think that's kind of the common perception. It's hard to do that.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not. And that's not where the question was.
Oh, absolutely. But yeah. I'm agreeing with you that I think that the perception that you've kind of betrayed your neighborhood or your community, I think it's just a lack of opportunity. If there were other things that people could do, because as an African-American, and Eric may speak to this as well, you never really get away from that community, no matter how educated you are or not. And so it's really, I think, about also creating other opportunities for growth and success in addition to just higher education.
Pastor Height, I'd like to hear your thoughts as well.
Well, I think underscore what each has said, this is a complex issue. There's no one solution, and it's a matter, and no matter what we say, I can't break the cycle of poverty for someone. I can only give them the tools and give them the opportunity, and at the end of the day, they have to make those decisions to do what they want to do. And I think that it's harder and harder with the tools that are presented for folks to break out. I think issues like, as we heard in the one report, folks who have felonies, we are a society that doesn't comprehend that if someone has paid their dues, that maybe we need to give them another opportunity. And the whole idea of banning the box is a question that I think we have to grapple with. A lot of my neighbors are folks who've made bad choices. And many times the difference between maybe myself and them is very little, other than I had maybe different opportunities than they did. And they made choices that were much different than the choices that I had, because they had limited opportunities to choose from. As we have lived here and raised our family, my wife and I, we've seen some of our neighbors make tragic decisions, and it comes down to I think sometimes they don't think they have any other option or any other choice. We've heard from them the lack of hopelessness, and I think we have to continue to give them opportunities. I think couple of my very dear friends who serve with me here at Shepherd Community are folks who grew up in this neighborhood, and I'll ask them, why are you here? What was it? And you know, they may have a sibling who had the similar opportunities but made drastically different choices. And I think sometimes there it's we have to remind ourselves that folks will make decisions, and we can give them all the opportunities they want. I just don't know that we have given enough resources to in these very targeted areas and opportunities that they realize that they have another way out.
We are talking about life in some of Indianapolis's most distressed neighborhoods. If you would like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi. Or you can do what a listener named Stephanie has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Stephanie, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Yeah, so first I have to say hi to one of my good friend, Eric. I'm so glad he's on the show today. But my question for everybody there is, how might an increase in the minimum wage to more of a living wage impact the quality of life and even the crime rate in some of these distressed neighborhoods that we're talking about?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Stephanie. I'll throw that one probably to Brianka first.
Sure. I think that the minimum wage, I'm not really sure necessarily financially what that might statistically look like in terms of payoff for residents. But I think, again, it kind of goes back to what kind of jobs are those? Where are those people working? I think Ryan interviewed someone who had a girlfriend, I think it was Mr. Buford maybe, who worked as a convenience store clerk. And I think her paycheck was the only thing that was kind of keeping them going. And so, you know, when you're talking about raising a family and you're the only person who's providing an income, that can go a long way, at least anecdotally.
How much of this is, because, you know, we hear a lot, it's a political season, and the fact that there are more Hoosiers now working than at any other time in the history of the state. But at the same time, we are seeing more Hoosiers losing their hold on the lower end of the middle class. Somewhere between 1 in 5 and 1 in 4 of the children, but between 20 and 25% of the children in this state live below the poverty line. How much of this is that the economy and at least the job strategy here in the state isn't generating enough jobs for people to live? Ryan, I'll throw that one to you, but I'd like to hear Eric's thoughts on that as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I just wanted to, I guess, throw out some numbers as well. I mean, one thing, a big thing in these neighborhoods is the unemployment rate. I've heard from several people say that, you know, it still really feels like there's a recession in these neighborhoods. You know, Pastor Height mentioned it to me that, you know, the housing crisis, you know, hit some of these neighborhoods particularly hard, especially the Near East Side. You have unemployment rates in these neighborhoods that are 23%, you know, 3-4 times as high as the countywide average or the statewide average. So, you know, some of those numbers about an improving economy that you hear, a lot of people in these neighborhoods don't feel like that really is true to them or, you know, is really you know, life in those neighborhoods.
And actually, before I hear Eric's thoughts, we've actually, through the speak-up phone, we've got a woman, someone who lives in one of those neighborhoods, speaking to that feeling precisely. If we could listen to Lillian talking about her one word.
My name is Lillian. I'm 40-plus. The one word that describes my neighborhood is one in recession. I say that because our community has not benefited from all the tax dollars that have been poured through the system in paving our roads or including any commerce in the area. We don't have many grocery stores, very few filling stations, and the roads are very, very bad. Also, there's no immediate resources poured in terms of demolishing vacant houses.
That was a listener named Lillian talking about how the recession has affected life in her neighborhood. And I'd asked how much of this is the fact that we seem to be splitting into two different kinds of economy, or some economists talk about it as an hourglass economy, where we're going to have a lot of people at the top, a lot of people at the bottom, and not a whole lot in the middle. Eric, your thoughts?
What I see and just across the board is a lot of people starting their own business and to make an impact in the community. But at the same time, in a lot of communities in which we talk about these targeted areas, it almost sounds like, you know, the tone is who's going to come from outside of this neighborhood to improve this neighborhood. And that can't be the case always. And I'm not saying that that's not wanted or needed. It definitely is. But if we're going to talk about some long term impact, then what's going to happen to generate that boom, that new consciousness, so to speak, that commerce, as she was talking about, within the neighborhoods, and that certain empowerment. Let's not be confused here. Everybody, just because I'm in this neighborhood, we are not all on the same page. Mm-hmm. We, you know.
Real human beings
right,
here, right?
Right. People, you know, the concept of organizing, you know, you got a handful of people in Indianapolis, and I've just been blessed to meet a lot of people out here in the community that are really trying to urge, but they can only do so much. And so, again, when we put things in context, you know, I mentioned Ryan put in his report talking about redlining. These things have residual effects. Mm-hmm. And so, again, I appreciate his report, because when people ask, well, how did the problem happen? I said, just look at what happened during time. That has to be rectified. It's coming back and is not just biting one group of people, but now it's biting many groups of people. Now it's a problem.
We are talking about life in some of Indianapolis's most distressed neighborhoods, which is the focus of an innovative series of stories called Intersections by Ryan Delaney of WFYI News. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're taking a look at life in some of Indianapolis's most distressed neighborhoods. Those neighborhoods are the subject of an innovative series of stories called Intersections by Ryan Delaney of WFYI News. Ryan is one of my guests, along with Bianca Merritt from SPIA's Public Policy Institute, Eric Saunders, who grew up near East 42nd and Post Road and the Meadows, which are both now focus areas. He's now the Voluntary Outreach and Engagement Coordinator for Big Brothers Big Sisters, and Pastor Jay Height, who is pastor at Shepherd Community Center in the Near East Side focus area. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, we're going to listen to another one of the reports, Ryan. Could you set this up real quickly?
Yeah, this goes actually all the way back to a conversation I had with Jay. He was one of the first people I interviewed for this, so I appreciate him letting me talk him into coming onto the show. But one of the things that he told me last summer was that all the kids in these neighborhoods and everywhere in the city will be mentored as they grow up. It's really just a question of by whom. And that kind of theme of family dynamic and who is raising these kids and the environments that they're being raised in is something that really kind of stuck with me and kept coming up in a lot of different ways. And I met one family in particular and who... A grandmother, a single grandmother, is raising seven of her grandchildren because, you know, her daughter struggles with substance abuse and is unable to care for these kids. The one boy in particular who you'll hear, his father was murdered when Daryl was 2 years old. And it's really kind of this battle almost playing out, if that is the right word, of, you know, who is going to look out for these kids? You know, good role models like this grandmother or mentors or gang members. Finances are more stable now, but Mays will retire soon. She'll be 84 when she's done raising children.
Their lives would probably be so much different if their parents were here with them, but they're not here. It's just me.
As mature as Daryl is, though, he still needs his grandmother and Mr. Beverly looking out for him, like when his classmates tried to get him to join their gang, which they did by beating him up.
They make you go 30.
30 seconds of punches from each of them.
I went 30 with all of them. You're like, you got to defend yourself like when you go 30, because like, if you don't, they're going to be talking about you. Call you names and punks and all that extra stuff.
He was able to switch to a different class and get away from the gang. But the story doesn't always end that way. Gang recruitment at school is common, so those who work to keep kids away from crime have to intervene early.
Good day.
A group of fidgety first graders files into a room at IPS School 15 on Indy's Near East Side. This is a racially diverse but challenged neighborhood with high rates of poverty, prostitution, and drug addiction.
So let's start.
When James Taylor, JT he goes by, rubs a prayer bowl, they go quiet. For a moment at least. Taylor is a laid-back 73-year-old. His long dreadlocks turned gray during his 30 years working for the Peace Learning Center.
Did I read this book last time?
Taylor reads them books about getting along and being respectful. It may not seem like much, but he says such lessons can be absent at home. He says gangs increasingly fill a void a parent should occupy.
Our kids just want to be accepted, loved, and honored, and they'll get that wherever they get it, and gangs is not where we want them to get it, but if a gang is recruiting folk going, hey, we'll love you and all of that, that's not exactly what they mean, but that's how they get our kids.
That was one of the stories done by Ryan Delaney of WFYI News as part of his Intersection series. If you'd like to hear the project in its entirety, you can find it at wfyi.org/intersections. What we're really talking about here, it strikes me, is folks who are trying to build what we consider a sense of community. Mm. And I've heard Eric pretty strongly saying that has to come. That's not something that can be imposed from without. It's something that has to come from from within. But we've gotten an email from a listener named Eddie, and I'm gonna go to the trouble of boiling your email down, because we've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. If you'd like to reach out to us by email, as Eddie has done, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Eddie's asking, are there ways, because it seems that his argument is that part of the problem seems to be that when poverty becomes isolated from other middle-class wealth and all of that, that creates a kind of stigma and adds to the dynamic. Are there ways that when gentrification takes place, or any other ways that we can create neighborhoods in which people of different economic groups are actually living together, and would that solve the problem? Are there things that, in other words, a city, a community, a state, or a country can do to help alleviate some of these pressures and to help the people who are in these neighborhoods create communities that they would like? Pastor Hyde, I'm going to start with you on that one.
There was a time in Indianapolis history when a group of community leaders would get together and said they had a vision for what Indianapolis could be. It wasn't what it was, but what it could be. And the amateur sports capital of the world, and they thought that they could build a downtown and revive it before we even had a football team. And I think the challenge today is for us to become the youth mentoring capital of the world. And that same connection of Republicans working with Democrats and business leaders working with neighborhood leaders to come together and say, we want to take the greatest resource we have, and that's our youth, and we want to create mentors for them. And if we became the youth mentoring capital of the world, and folks took time out of their busy weeks to invest in a kid's life, to coach a team, to be a Girl Scout leader, to work at their local church, and to do these different types of community activities, we would change the trajectory of this city and truly capitalize on the greatest resource we have.
We are talking about life in distressed neighborhoods in Indianapolis. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named French has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. French, welcome to the program.
Yes, how are you doing today?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I was just talking to someone before I got on here, and we was talking about the problems of the inner city community. Well, the inner city community is suffering from economics. We're suffering from economics. What I'm trying to do with a pastor that's like right around the corner is to defuse black on black crime. People who have beef, we're supposed to come together and put flowers out, and put my number on it, the pastor number on it, and diffuse. Like, if you got a problem with the next person, we want to diffuse some of the black-on-black crime, killing each other and all that. But we suffer from economic problems. There's no outreach. You have plenty of churches in these communities, and all they doing, from my view, is taking money from every mother that has sons. And about time the sons, it's time for them to send them to college or help them do something, they done gave all their blessings away to a church. And the church is not helping. In my view, they're not helping people that really need help. We have economic problems where no one is outreaching. We need to farm. It's like when they pulled up this railroad track, there was no black guys on the workforce. We were good enough to build the railroad tracks, but when it comes time to pay somebody to pull the railroad tracks up, there was not one single black guy over here helping them pull these railroad tracks up.
Okay.
There's no solution. Okay.
French, let Eric, I think in particular, respond to this. I take your point here that
one quick thing I want to say. when it comes to trying to defuse crime, mm-hmm. okay, if you catch a drug felony, you can't get food stamps no more. But people who don't have drug felonies, they get $195 in food stamps a month. That keeps them from going to do something to, that keeps them from going out here doing something silly, trying to make some money to get something to eat. It all comes from hunger. If you got a hungry community, you can only live with stomach pains for so long. Then if you're not fed, then you can't think right. And if you can't think right, you can't act right. So we have a whole lot of, you have things going on with the justice system. The justice system, you get in trouble.
French, I do want to let Eric respond to this. Thank you very much for calling in, though, because you've raised some very important points. Eric.
Frenchman, you went there, man, and in regards to, you know, churches and everything like that, and I'm not trying to ruffle any feathers in there, but you have a lot of people who are disgruntled within the community in regards to the church's involvement in that regard. And I want to give, you know, shout out to the churches that are out there that are connecting economically to what's going on in the community to be able to provide and see that those resources are actually going back into the congregation and the things that are going to uplift the community. And so that's all I'll say about that. But I will definitely agree, man, that everything's all connected. So when I heard you saying that, it just really kind of reminded me of how everything's connected. And so just even riding around the communities now, when you don't see grocery stores, mm-hmm. Where there are normally grocery stores, and again, you know, I'm a proponent for mentors, but this is what I don't want to see happen in the community. I don't want people to go to that as if that is the solution, because we've done a great job, Big Brothers, Big Sisters, and engaging more volunteers to step up, and they're doing it. We need the city's help in making sure that some of the issues in which the youth are facing, that you're doing your part to making sure that, and a mentor, we ask that you do so much, and that seed that you sow is great, but we need to make sure that the soil is tilled right. And so so I applaud all those that are actually out there mentoring and helping kids. But I also challenge other members of our communities to make sure that, you know, issues such as, you know, maybe getting suspended for dress code or expelled and things like that, ridiculous things that we are seeing that are also plaguing the community that that a mentor might not be able to put his hand on or her hand on immediately. So thank you, Frenchman, because you touched on some good points.
Ryan, you wanted to add something.
Yeah, just quickly, I think an example to go back to, you were talking about community and diversity, and there's a situation last summer in the Butler Tarkington neighborhood of Indy, around the, you know, 40th and Illinois or so, where there was a outbreak, a very terribly violent couple of weeks, and that was a neighborhood that you saw that really came out and came together, neighborhood associations holding marches and really reaching out to IMPD and holding meetings, and that's actually a neighborhood that's one of the most racially diverse of this city, one that has been racially diverse since the 60s compared to, you know, other parts of the city. And I think it's just very much an example of what can happen when you do have a neighborhood that is very involved with each other and involved in public safety.
We've gotten a Facebook message from a listener named Renee, and if you'd like to reach out to us on Facebook, you can do so at, find us at No Limits WFYI. She says, investing in distressed neighborhoods is a double-edged sword, because investments many times result in increasing property values. The low-income families in those areas become disenfranchised. Revitalization and affordable housing have to coexist, yet they don't. Bianca, you're nodding your head, so I'm going with you on this one. I mean, some of this is that, yes, once the neighborhoods improve, too often the dynamic is that the people who lived there and did the work to help them improve can no longer afford to live there.
Yes. I think Eric spoke a little bit earlier about redlining and some other mm-hmm. issues. I mean, this is an issue that's been going on for decades, where for better or for worse, people get the resources and the wealth and they go to places that can support that, whether it's culturally, financially, school districts, and other things that are surrounded with that. Indianapolis, I think, is trying to do a good job. Ryan brought up Butler Tarkington. I don't know that there is really a place in America where there is just a very consistent community that is economically diverse, racially diverse, and all these things that we're talking about. I think that there's no quick and easy solution to that. It takes a little time, but I'm nodding my head because I generally agree with her statement. I don't know the answer to that question, but
we're getting close on time here. So I'm gonna ask, because you're right. The last time Indiana had a presidential I guess 2008, we had a presidential primary that really mattered. Before that, it was 1968. And one of the issues then really was how do we deal primarily with urban poverty? Robert Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy were arguing about that along with Lyndon Johnson. So you're right. These issues have been around for a long time. If you could, in about 20 seconds, and I'm going to start with you, Pastor Haidt, give us one concrete thing we could do that might help.
Recognize that it's a person's responsibility to do what they can to help. In whatever area that they have the ability, I would sum it up to a personal responsibility. We can't put it off on government. We can't put it off on organizations. It's people helping their neighbors.
Eric.
I would say that it's time to challenge our values from the top down. I would encourage people to learn more about legislation and what's going on and the decisions that's being made. And I would really challenge everybody who values integrity. This is the time to see where your integrity truly lies, because right now, if you see something wrong that's happening, you know, whether you did something or whether you not or that you didn't do something, it's like, what are you going to do now that you have been exposed to the truth?
Bianca.
I think from a policy perspective, starting now and hoping for long-term gains, not just focusing on the little quick fixes, whether it's policing or doing small things in the community in terms of grocery stores and other things which are important, but taking a long-term view to it, working with youth like Eric said and like Pastor Haidt said, and taking a long-term approach.
Ryan, I'm going to give you the last word here.
Oh, boy. Well, I'm certainly not the expert on this. I guess quickly, you know, I talked to a sociologist last year, and I asked him whether or not, you know, if I came back to him in 5-10 years, if these neighborhoods would be the same ones. And to go back to the gentrification thing, you know, probably not. We're going to see this city change, and especially some of these focus areas that are pretty close to downtown change, and poverty and that face of poverty is changing. And I think we need to realize that it's going to be in different parts of the city. These problems are not going to go away. They'll probably just move.
I'd like to thank you all. I'd like to thank my guests, Ryan Delaney, Bianca Merritt, Eric Saunders, and Pastor Jay Haidt for what has been a fascinating conversation. I'd like to invite all of our listeners to come back on Tuesday when we're going to be talking about the primary election. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cherzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.